The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Hopefully you had a nice weekend. We had a beautiful weekend here at Edstone. Some time to get out and about, spend some time outdoors, some beautiful sunshine, and hopefully some rain later on this week. There's a little bit of it in the forecast. I understand it's pretty hot in Edmond, Oklahoma as well for the PYC, so we'll certainly be praying for God to protect our young people so that they don't overdo it, but yet that they can still really pour their hearts into that experience, a life-changing experience for so many of our young people. We've been running these camps since, 1991 or two, I believe. So going on 3 decades of youth camps in this final era of God's church, 3 decades of youth camps sponsored by the Philadelphia Church of God. And speaking of those 3 decades, there was a time right at the start of that when, we were in the midst of a spiritual drought, you could say. For 3.5 years, following the death of Herbert Armstrong on January 16th, 1986, it was 3.5 years later that I first read Malachi's message to God's church today. It was the first individual to read that book. Of course, prior to that time, a few months, in fact, my father was writing the book, and then I was the first to read it. And as he's written before, in the James booklet in particular, it was on this day back in 1989, July 16th, 1989, that the refreshing spiritual rain started to pour down upon the church yet again. Of course, it started in the smallest of possible ways, but we have really seen a lot of mustard seed-like growth over the past 29 years. Lots of things going on in the work right now with the exhibit, with the numbers of people visiting the exhibit, and of course, all that we've been talking to you about this summer, too, about the public speaking appearances or the PAC campaigns. There's another one in South Carolina, I believe, next week, next Sunday and next Monday. So we'll certainly be looking forward to hearing more about that in the days ahead. Well, on today's show, we'll spend some time on these indictments from Friday, the big announcement by Mr. Rosenstein, that they're going after these Russians, high-ranking Russian officials who meddled in the U.S. election back in 2016. And also, later on in the show, we'll talk more about the 3.5 years of drought and the spiritual rain. We'll especially study the 5th chapter of the book of James, so you might get your Bible handy so that we can study some of those scriptures together. But first, I want to start with, I believe it's what President Trump said yesterday regarding the European Union. He sat down and he's given lots of interviews on this trip that he's on. He's in Russia, or not in Russia. He's meeting with the Russian president. Where is he meeting again?
Finland.
He's meeting with Vladimir Putin in Finland. We'll have more to say about that on tomorrow's program. But more comments. I think on Friday's Trumpet Hour, either it was Richard Palmer or Joel Hilliker referred to him as the disruptor, the disruptor in chief. And he certainly came into his meetings with NATO last week, certainly not subscribing to the status quo. I mean, he's shaking things up. And then he continued to do that to some extent when here in the UK. But this is one exchange that he had with a reporter, I believe, yesterday. Here's clip one.
Who's your biggest competitor, your biggest foe globally right now?
Well, I think we have a lot of foes. I think the European Union is a foe, what they do to us in trade.
Now, you wouldn't think of the European Union, but they're a foe.
Who's your biggest foe? And that was his first response. He comes on after that. He talked about Russia and China. They're certainly foes as well. But then the reporter comes back and says, you know, really, people are going to be surprised that you would put the EU first, or that's the first thing that you would say. Here's clip two.
A lot of people might be surprised to hear you list the EU as a foe before China and Russia.
No, I look at them all. Look, EU is very difficult. I want to tell you, maybe the thing that's most difficult, don't forget, both my parents were born in EU sectors, okay? I mean, my mother was Scotland, my father was Germany, and, you know, I love those countries. I respect the leaders of those countries, but in a trade sense, they've really taken advantage of us, and many of those countries are in NATO. And they weren't paying their bills. And, you know, I, as an example, have a big problem with Germany because Germany made a pipeline deal with Russia where they're going to be paying Russia billions and billions of dollars a year for energy. And I say that's not good. That's not fair. You're supposed to be fighting for someone, and then that someone gives billions of dollars to the one that you're, you know, guarding against. I think it's ridiculous. So I let that be known also this time. And I tell you what, there's a lot of anger at the fact that Germany is paying Russia billions of dollars. There's a lot of anger. I also think it's a very bad thing for Germany because it's like, what are they, waving a white flag?
I don't think it's been since World War II that a U.S. president has talked about Germany in particular and, of course, the EU in this way. How difficult the EU is being. And they're not paying their bills. We went through some of that last week. But to again single out Germany and say that Germany's waving a white flag of all things. Well, EU officials were swift to respond. America and EU are best friends, says EU Council President Donald Tusk. Best friends. Whoever says we are not is spreading fake news. Or he said specifically, whoever says we are foes is spreading fake news. A not-so-veiled reference to Donald Trump. It says here, calling your best friends foes only makes your real foes happy. That's from European Commission Vice President Frans Timmermans. So they were quick to respond. But going back to even some of the things we brought out last week, as the Spectator noted over the weekend, I mean, the worst thing about President Trump's outbursts on Brexit, for example, or NATO or Germany is, as the Spectator says, he's right. He's right. It said over the weekend, this came out before these most recent comments about the EU being a foe. But this is what the Spectator said. Yet for all his bluster and offensiveness, Trump often has a point. Take, for example, what he tweeted on Tuesday. This was ahead of the NATO summit about how that the tariffs that they put upon incoming food, it makes it impossible, as he said in his tweet, for U.S. farmers and workers to compete. And then he mentioned the trade deficit, as he's been saying over and over and again. But the Spectator says here, it's hard to fault this analysis. The EU has spent much of the past few weeks complaining bitterly about Trump's shameless declaration of a trade war, the first shots of which have been fired through tariffs on steel and aluminum. Yet at the same time, it has overlooked the trade war which it has been waging. This is the EU. The trade war that the EU has been waging against the outside world for decades on agricultural products. For decades, and not even just the tariffs, all of the regulations, as Richard Palmer brings out in his most recent article at The Trumpet. The Spectator says it's also right for Trump to raise the stakes on the issue of how much NATO members are contributing to the alliance. It is a blunt fact that 24 out of 29 NATO members are ratting on the agreement that they should spend at least 2% of the GDP on defense. Those countries, it says finally, are attempting to shelter beneath the U.S. military umbrella while refusing to stick to the rules they agreed. So they're not playing by the rules, and President Trump's calling them on the carpet for that, and they don't like it. Richard brings out in his piece, this is again in the latest Trumpet magazine, how that Germany, I mean, besides the tariffs that Germany is happy to slap on, you know, incoming goods, they also use the euro to cheat. They use the euro to get the upper hand because they share the euro with all these struggling neighbors. And so it's a weaker currency. And if you take it as a whole, it's a weaker currency than it would be if it was just the German mark, like it was, a couple decades ago. So what this does is it makes German goods cheaper in the United States, and then it makes the American goods more expensive in Germany. And so Germany benefits. Germany laughs all the way to the bank. It's like just the euro itself is like an invisible subsidy. So friend or foe, well, I love them. I mean, I think highly of these nations. But I mean, when you look at the fact that they won't pay their bills, and then look at these unreasonable tariffs. Well, the unintended consequences of this, as was covered on the Trumpet Hour Friday, is that it's just going to drive a greater wedge between the United States and Europe, between the United States and Germany in particular, and all of that is prophesied, to be sure. Look at Richard's article in the latest Trumpet. Europe and America, they've lost that loving feeling. That's in the latest Trumpet magazine. It was just posted at the website a few days ago. We haven't yet received the hard copies here at Edstone, but certainly something to dig into once you receive it. Well, the big announcement on Friday, when I heard Mr. Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, announce the indictment of these 12, I guess it is, Russian intelligence officers, I tweeted that story that we've played clips from it a couple of times already. That CNN report from back in April, I think it was, March or April, where it talked about how that this individual at the White House was sounding the alarm about Russian interference in elections. He was sounding the alarm in 2015. And CNN was saying Obama and his officials did nothing about it. And then they interviewed all these people saying, well, we didn't have funding and there was this and there was that. We'll probably end up playing it again for you at some point. But of course, the media, I mean, they really took Rosenstein's announcement on Friday and they ran with it because this is serious now. It's very serious under a Trump administration. Not so much when Obama was in power. But now this is serious. I mean, it confirms everything that they believe about the evil Trump administration. And yet, what exactly did Mr. Rosenstein say? Well, here's a sampling, clip 16.
The indictment charges 12 Russian military officers by name for conspiring to interfere with the 2016 presidential election. There is no allegation in this indictment that any American citizen committed a crime. There's no allegation that the conspiracy changed the vote count or affected any election result.
So no Americans involved, and it didn't change the election result. So they basically got 12 Russian hackers, and this, keep in mind, was going on all throughout the Obama administration. It seemed like every 3-4 months we were writing about another massive hack attack during the Obama years from Russia, from China. But now it's real serious. Of course, these individuals, they're never gonna end up in a U.S. courtroom. Nothing like that will happen. It's just much ado about nothing. That's not to say, you know, don't go after someone if they're committing a crime, if they're spying or stealing or disrupting a free election. But by issuing the indictments, I mean, that doesn't catch the individuals. I mean, if you're going to catch them, you need to do it covertly. Now it's out in the open. Of course they're not going to travel to the United States. Fox News, reporting on the Friday announcement, said a federal grand jury has indicted 12 Russian intelligence officers for allegedly hacking emails from the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Democratic Party during the 2016 election. It says further on, today's charges include no allegations of knowing involvement by anyone on the campaign and no allegations that the alleged hacking affected the election results. That's quoting a White House official. This is what we've been saying all along. There's no American citizens involved. It didn't impact the election. And so it was just a hack job. I mean, and not a very impactful one, evidently. And again, not unlike the many other hacks that have been going on all through the Obama years that have been going on. Well, probably when you talk about meddling, I mean, like one congressman pointed out in the testimony last week. I mean, this has been going on for decades. President Trump, he tweeted over the past 24 hours saying here, President Obama thought, listen to this and see how much of this you think is true. President Obama thought that crooked Hillary, you know, leave out the derogatory terms. He thought that Hillary was going to win the election. So when he was informed by the FBI about Russian meddling, he said it couldn't happen, that it was no big deal, and he did nothing about it. When I won, it became a big deal, and the rigged witch hunt headed by Strzok, it became a big deal, and it led to the witch hunt, as he keeps calling it. That's true. What he said there is true. We'll play the sound bites here for you in just a moment. The fact that when the FBI told him about Russian meddling, that's Barack Obama, I mean, he didn't do anything about it, and he said it's not going to impact the election. It can't happen. There's no way a U.S. election can be rigged. It's not a big deal. And then suddenly Donald Trump wins, and it's a huge deal. Listen to this analysis from CNN on Friday following Rosenstein's announcement, clip 3.
The president has said, I'm going to ask him, Vladimir Putin, I don't know if he's going to say anything. I mean, what Rod Rosenstein, his own deputy attorney general, was effectively saying is, that's not good enough. And that's what we've heard from Republicans and Democrats. You can't just say, please don't do it. I mean, this is a major, major diplomatic breach. This is a major crime perpetuated by the man that the president is going to go and meet with. So to just say, did you hack? No. Okay. Then, or did you meddle? No. Okay. Well, if you did, don't do it again. No.
Well, that's exactly what President Obama did when he was made aware of it. He was made aware back in September of 2016 that this is going on. They're interfering with our election. And he basically met with Vladimir Putin and said, hey, you got to stop it. You got to stop with that. This is how Obama explained it. Clip 4.
What I was concerned about in particular was making sure that that wasn't compounded by potential hacking that could hamper vote counting, affect the actual election process itself. And so in early September, when I saw President Putin in China, I felt that the most effective way to ensure that that didn't happen was to talk to him directly and tell him to cut it out. And there were going to be some serious consequences if he didn't.
He said cut it out. And Vladimir Putin, I guess, didn't stop. It didn't. That was the most effective way to stop it. Just tell him right to his face, hey, stop it. Hey, cut this out. And now CNN comes along helpfully and says, you can't just look him in the face at this summit and say, hey, cut it out. Well, that's what Mr. Trump's predecessor did. This is from the New York Times. This is last year, a year ago, June 21st, 2017. It says, around mid-August, Mr. Johnson said, federal officials began hearing reports of scanning and probing of some state voter database registries. This is June last year, and it's talking about mid-August 2016, okay? This is during the election year. This is a full 2-3 months before the election on November 8th. So they started to hear all of this chatter online. And the New York Times is reporting, saying in the weeks after, intelligence officials became convinced the Russians were behind these efforts, okay? So they became convinced, all of these intelligence communities, or there's like 17 agencies, I think, that put a report together to tell the Obama administration about it. It says the administration formally accused the Russian government on October 7th. That's a full month before the election, the U.S. election, when Mr. Johnson and James Clapper, then the director of National Intelligence, released a statement saying the Russians had leaked information intended to interfere with the U.S. election process. So the director of National Intelligence is telling President Obama this is going on. The USA Today, that same year, from December of 2016, this is around the time that President Obama was giving his final press conference, during which he talked about, hey, I told him to cut it out. The USA Today says, on October 7th, the Department of Homeland Security and Office of Director of National Intelligence, that's Clapper, issued a joint statement on behalf of the U.S. intelligence community. The U.S. intelligence community is made up of 16 agencies. 16 agencies that were telling the Obama administration, this is going on. This is going on. And what was the Obama administration telling the American people? Here's clip five.
And in fact, we did not see further tampering of the election process.
So he got the report October 7th. It was official, and he looked into it. He looked at Vladimir Putin, and he said, hey, cut it out. And then what they discovered the rest of the way is that there was no further tampering. Clip six.
So when I look back in terms of how we handled it, I think we handled it the way it should have been handled.
They did a pretty good job, in his view. He feels like they did everything by the book. But did they? Well, look at the announcement on Friday. Now, as I say, it's very serious. And the media, they don't want to be presented with this. It's just less than 2 years ago, in fact. Before, those clips were from his final press conference in December of 2016. Here's what he said in October of 2016. This is weeks before the election. Keep in mind, it's October 18th, so this is after he's made aware of this from 17 intelligence agencies, okay? And here's what President Obama told the nation, clip seven.
There is no serious person out there who would suggest somehow that you could even rig America's elections, in part because they're so decentralized and the numbers of votes involved. There's no evidence that that has happened in the past or that there are instances in which that will happen this time.
So no serious person can say that the election was rigged, and really Rosenstein confirmed that on Friday. Look, we went after these Russians. We've issued these indictments. But it didn't impact the election. And no Americans were involved. And that's why they were brushing it off back before the election, that they thought Hillary would win. Because it's the kind of thing that just goes on all the time. And if it was serious in their minds, they had every opportunity to aggressively go after it. As it was, I mean, White House security officials were told to stand down. We've gone through that before with you as well. In addition to the CNN report saying that they didn't do anything. I forget the guy's name, Bruin or someone in that CNN report. He advised the White House. Here's a little more from that October 18th press conference. This is President Obama several weeks before the U.S. election. Let's see, this is clip eight.
I have never seen in my lifetime or in modern political history any presidential candidate trying to discredit the elections and the election process before votes have even taken place. It's unprecedented. It happens to be based on no facts. Every expert, regardless of political party, regardless of ideology, conservative or liberal, who has ever examined these issues in a serious way will tell you that instances of significant voter fraud are not to be found.
That's Obama from October 18, 2016. At the time, Donald Trump was out there calling into question the election process. Remember, with Hillary and Bernie Sanders, I mean, the Democratic National Committee rigged it so that Hillary would win. Bernie Sanders was getting a little bit too, he was getting too much popularity. And so the DNC worked it out. This is what Mr. Trump had to go on. He saw it happening. It came out in some of those emails that were hacked. It was rigged. And so he was questioning the November election as well. President Obama's shocked. It's unprecedented that anyone would ever criticize the election process. No serious person would ever suggest that you could rig the American election. And so here was his advice to Donald Trump at the time, clip 9.
You start whining before the game's even over. If whenever things are going badly for you and you lose, you start blaming somebody else, then you don't have what it takes to be in this job.
And that's what the Democrats have been doing ever since November 8th. They will not accept the results from that election. Now they say, and have been saying, since November 8th, 2016, they've been saying that the U.S. election was rigged. And not only the Russians, not only were the Russians involved, Trump himself, Donald Trump himself. One more clip from October 18th, 2016, clip 10.
And so I'd advise Mr. Trump to stop whining and go try to make his case to get votes.
And he did. He got enough to win. He was the one that was campaigning like crazy those last few days in Wisconsin, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, some of those swing states. And he got the votes. He got the votes. Here's another, clip 11.
And if he got the most votes, then it would be my expectation of Hillary Clinton to offer a gracious concession speech and pledge to work with him in order to make sure that the American people benefit from an effective government. And it would be my job to welcome Mr. Trump, regardless of what he said about me or my differences with him on my opinions, and escort him over to the Capitol, in which there would be a peaceful transfer of power. That's what Americans do.
Well, here again, there has been no peaceful transfer of power. They still are fighting it. They still want to bring him down. They still desperately hope somehow, some way, that Mueller's going to find officials in the Trump administration that were involved in this hacking, I guess. He went on to say how that if you start betraying these American traditions, I mean, you're going to undermine the United States of America. You're going to undermine everything that's been holding this democracy together for two centuries. That was Barack Obama waxing eloquent back in October of 2016. During the time when they thought Hillary Clinton was a shoo-in to win, to become the next president. Now, if you go back to that testimony from Peter Strzok on Thursday, we went through a fair bit of that on Friday's program, I know. But if you recall, he's prefaced his entire testimony on the Russian attack on the U.S. election process. Here again is what he had to say on Thursday. This is clip 13.
I understand we're living in a political era in which insults and insinuation often drown out honesty and integrity. But the honest truth is that Russian interference in our elections constitutes a grave attack on our democracy. Most disturbingly, it has been wildly successful, sowing discord in our nation and shaking faith in our institutions. I have the utmost respect for Congress's oversight role, but I strongly believe today's hearing is just another victory notch in Putin's belt and another milestone in our enemy's campaign to tear America apart.
And as I was saying on Friday's program, of course, back at the time when all of this investigation got going, they say July of 2016, the Trump officials believe it was even earlier than that, or those defending the president. But at the time, I mean, it was all about getting Donald Trump. And you see it clear as day in Peter Strzok's text messages, his emails. But now, I mean, there's just the concern about Russian interference. Now that's the way that it's framed. I mean, his entire testimony really was framed on the fact that this is a grave attack, Russian interference. And just putting this on display the way that we're doing here today, it's a victory notch in Putin's belt. Now, listen to this. We didn't play this for you on Friday, but this was an exchange that Peter Strzok had on Thursday, the hearing, with Representative Labrador from Ohio. Here's clip 14.
You'll be surprised, but I actually believe that the Russians tried to destabilize our economy, our way of life, our government. I think they have been doing it for a long time. I'm curious if this is the first time that Russia tried to interfere with an American election.
I'm aware of times where they, you know, going back to the 60s and 70s, where they planted evidence, where they were seeking to introduce items of information that were false in newspapers. I'm not aware of any direct outreach to members of a presidential, either the candidate or his immediate team.
Did they attempt to interfere in the 2012 elections?
I'm certain they did, yes.
Yeah. So do you recall when President Obama telling Russian President Medvedev that he would have more flexibility to negotiate on issues like missile defense after the 2012 election?
I don't remember that, sir. No.
He said that in a hot mic. Why wasn't that investigated?
Sir, because, there were no allegations to my knowledge.
That's a fascinating exchange there. It's Representative Labrador from Idaho. I said Ohio. But here he is asking Peter Strzok, who headed up the investigation into Russian interference, the Russian-Trump collusion, in 2016. Are you aware of any other efforts to interfere? Oh, yes. 1960s, 70s, planted evidence all throughout. I mean, that's been the history of Russia. Did they attempt to interfere in 2012? I am certain they did, he said. He's certain of it. They were interfering in the election between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. And then the rep goes on to ask him, well, do you recall when he said, he said to Medvedev, I'll have more flexibility after I'm reelected. He doesn't remember that. Strzok doesn't. And then Representative Labrador says, well, why wasn't that investigated? If it was going on, if interference was going on in 2012, and you're working for the FBI, and then here's the statement, why wasn't this investigated? And then Strzok says, after he said he didn't even remember Obama saying that, he says, well, there were no allegations to my knowledge. Here's one more bit from that exchange, clip 15.
Do you recall during the debates when President Obama objected to candidate Romney that the 1980s are now calling to ask for their foreign policy book, The Cold War is Over? Do you remember that?
I don't.
Okay, so you were not interested in Russian interference with our elections in 2012, but you were interested in Russian interference in 2016.
That's not true, sir.
It's interesting and revealing as they keep framing it differently. Was there interference in 2012? I'm certain there was. Okay, well then these strange statements coming from Barack Obama, doesn't that sound a little bit odd? Why wasn't that investigated? Well, there's no allegations. About a month ago, Cheryl Atkinson, she had this article about, this was following the IG report with Inspector General Horowitz, came out with a 500 and some odd page report, remember, and the most damning evidence to come from that report concerned Peter Strzok, the one who was in the hearing on Thursday, the one testifying last Thursday. It says here, this is Cheryl Atkinson, Strzok is the subject of what I see as one of the most damaging conclusions in the Department of Justice Inspector General report. As the nation's top FBI counter-espionage official, he indicated, quote, this is from the IG report, a willingness to take official action to impact Donald Trump's electoral prospects. So here again, to paraphrase Strzok's concerns from last week, I mean, we're talking about interference in our elections, a grave attack. But where was the interference coming from primarily? It says here, specifically, while working on the Hillary Clinton classified email investigation in August 2016, Strzok wrote that he, well, it talks about the stop him text. Okay, we talked some on that Friday. And then Atkinson says, Strzok isn't just any rank and file guy spouting off in one ill-advised email. His fingerprints were on every FBI investigation that stood to impact Clinton's presidential candidacy or to hurt Trump before and after the 2016 election. She says he was the chief of the FBI's counterespionage section and the number two man in the FBI's counterintelligence division. He led the team of investigators in the Clinton classified email probe and led the FBI investigation into alleged Russia interference in the election. This was the man. This was the man investigating Russian interference back in 2016. Atkinson says, he was involved in the controversial anti-Trump Steele dossier used in part to obtain multiple secret wiretaps. He was the one who interviewed Trump advisor Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who pled guilty to lying to the FBI only to later learn that agents reportedly didn't think he'd lied. And Strzok was the top FBI agent appointed to work on the team of special counsel Robert Mueller to investigate alleged Trump-Russia collusion. He was the top man, the top FBI agent. Mueller appointed him as that. Until all these text messages came out and he had to fire him. Cheryl Atkinson says, the earth-shattering finding on Strzok by the inspector general confirms a citizenry's worst fears, a high-ranking government intel official allegedly conspired to affect the outcome of a presidential election, a U.S. presidential election. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send any comments to td@kpcg.fm. When we come back, we'll get into our study of James chapter 5. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
In those last years of the 1980s, it was a treacherous time for God's church. So much confusion and distrust. It was everywhere in the church, all these changes in doctrine coming out of Pasadena, California. Discontinuing Mystery of the Ages, announcing that decision in, I think it was early 1989, January of 1989. They had done it, I think, the previous year. But then my father, in those early months of 1989, he started working on a manuscript at the time to explain from the Bible why the Worldwide Church of God was making all of these doctrinal changes, to explain why it was happening, to explain how it was prophesied even. There were a number of Bible prophecies explaining what was happening in the church, God's church, at that time. And we would come to find this out later, of course. You can read about it in the James booklet. But it was during this critical period, from January of 1986 to March of 1989, and then through to this date, 29 years ago, July 16th, 1989, that a very specific prophecy in the book of James was being fulfilled in precise detail. This is James 5 and verse 17. It says, Elijah was a man subject to like passions as we are, and he prayed earnestly that it might not rain. And it rained not on the earth by the space of 3 years and 6 months. And then verse 18 says, and he prayed again, and heaven gave rain, and the earth brought forth her fruit. So a 3.5-year drought. Now, as my father brings out in the booklet, the Elijah of old, you can read about this in 1 Kings 17, he prophesied about rain and drought. And here, though, it says that an end-time Elijah, and I won't take the time to go into some of these other prophecies in Malachi 4 and Luke 1 and Isaiah 40 and so on, Malachi 3 as well, but here it refers to Elijah, an end-time Elijah, who prayed for this 3.5-year drought and then followed spiritual rain. So I talk about a specific prophecy, I mean, in minute detail being fulfilled. If you go from January 16th, 1986, when Mr. Armstrong died, to July 16th, 1989, when someone finally read the truth as it was revealed to my father, starting on March 11th, 1989, and so for a 3.5-year period, there was this drought. But then on July 16th, 1989, the rain started to pour down again. Spiritual rain started in God's church. Now, let's just back up and get some context from this really amazing chapter in the Bible, James chapter 5. It says here, and again, I'll paraphrase some of these points, and they're all taken from my father's booklet on the subject, the James booklet. But it says here, go you now, James 5, verse 1, go to now, you rich men, weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. God's addressing the Laodiceans here, who, if you read in Revelation 3, you can see there that God criticizes them for being rich and increased with goods. They've put material things ahead of God. Materialism. That's more important to them than God or his commandments. Then drop down to verse 4. It says, behold, the hire of the laborers who have reaped down your fields, which is of you, kept back by fraud, cries, and the cries of them which have reaped are entered into the ears of the eternal of Sabbath, it says. So this is the first verse where behold is mentioned. There's, I think, 4 instances in this chapter where God says behold, which means to look or to perceive. God's saying, look, I mean, you can, this verse in particular, verse 4, is talking about a Laodicean fraud. You can see it's fraudulent, their work. You can see by what they're doing, by the things that they're teaching, by the actions that they're taking. God is saying, behold, take note, look at what's happening. All of these laborers that helped to build up the work with their offerings and their sacrifice. But the leaders are corrupt. They've kept the wealth for themselves. That's the meaning here. Verse 5 says, you have lived in pleasure on the earth and been wanton. You have nourished your hearts as in the day of slaughter. God is saying to these Laodiceans, the leaders in particular, you're out there fattening yourself up right before the slaughter, and you don't even know it. They're blind to what's coming. They don't see it. And verse 6 says, you have condemned and killed the just, or the just one, which is the meaning there, and he does not resist you. So they've killed the righteous one. It's like they disfellowshipped him post-mortem. They, in a sense, kicked Mr. Armstrong out of the church. As soon as he died, I mean, he was out of the way, 2 Thessalonians 2. He was taken out of the way, and then the wicked was revealed. You look at some of the things leading up to Mr. Armstrong's death. I guess I don't have time to just go into a lot of detail here, but he produced Mystery of the Ages in the last year of his life. He, I think he went to the final SEP in Orr, Minnesota in August of 1985. He was too sick to go to the Feast of Tabernacles that year. And then he wrote, basically, the church heard from him. I think his last sermon message was on trumpets that fall. And then he wrote a series of coworker letters. And then there at the last, he started to concern himself with who would be his successor. And that ended up, of course, being Joseph Tkach. Mr. Armstrong selected him to be pastor general, not apostle. Mr. Tkach took that title himself about 10 months later. But he selected him to be pastor general early on in January of 1986. I think it was made official on January the 7th with Mr. Armstrong's assistant and the board of directors, whoever else was involved in that. But the Bible says that they condemned and killed the just one. I mean, they just, as soon as he died, they just blotted out his teachings. Spiritually speaking, they killed him. They killed his memory. They killed his teachings. What did Joe Tkach Jr. say later on during the court case? We have a Christian duty to keep these teachings out of print. We don't want them to ever see the light of day again. My father writes in the James booklet, toward the end of his life, Mr. Armstrong was surrounded by people of hate. The synagogue of Satan, Revelation 3:9, was already in place before he died. But he didn't resist them. Of course, he was old and frail and didn't have the strength to resist much of what they were doing. All he could really do was pray. And as it happens, that's what it says at the end of James 5. That's what he did. He prayed. He prayed for 3.5 years of drought. And then he prayed that it would rain again. After 3.5 years, God, restore. Restore that spiritual rain. Restore that truth, that revelation to your church, that refreshing spiritual rain of new revelation. And God says here in James 4 and verse 7, or chapter 5, sorry, he says, be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the eternal. Behold, the husbandman waits for the precious fruit of the earth and has long patience for it until he receives the early and latter rain. God's stressing the point of patience here, and you have to be patient. If you go back to Mr. Armstrong's ministry, I mean, how patient was he waiting on God one doctrine at a time? There was a time early on in his ministry where he didn't even know the meaning of the holy days that he observed. He just knew enough to obey them. He knew that they were commanded. But then there were those in the late 1980s, too, following the death of Herbert Armstrong, 2-3 years on, who were wondering, what is happening to the church? What is going on in the church? And the Bible says, be patient, therefore. Brethren, be patient unto the coming of the Lord. I mean, Christ's return, it still is, it's coming. You've got to have long patience for it. Wait for that precious fruit. Wait until he receives the early and the latter rain. Well, the latter rain, it resumed starting on July 16th, 1989. And verse 8 here says again, be also patient, be you also patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draws near. Over and again, you see James, he emphasizes the imminence of Jesus Christ's return. He mentions it here several times, in fact, in these few verses. Be established. Be established in this. And lead an upright life. Verse 9, grudge not one against another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge stands at the door. I mean, his coming is sure, and it is soon. Be patient. Verses 7 to 9 here, I mean, it talks about how close we are to the second coming. All of these events that we've seen happen in the true church of God, the great falling away, the latter rain restored, the refreshing spiritual rain resumes July 16th, 1989. Verse 10 says, take my brethren, the prophets who have spoken in the time of the eternal for an example of suffering affliction and of patience. Here again, and he mentions the example of Job, the patience of Job in the next verse. Hang on, be steadfast, don't give up hope. Don't turn away just because of painful or difficult trials. Let those trials deepen your conversion. Verse 13, it says, is any among you afflicted? Let him pray. Verse 14, is any sick among you? Let him call for the elders of the church and let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the eternal. And the prayer of faith, verse 15 says, shall save the sick. The effectual, fervent prayer, as the next verse brings out. That's what saves the sick. That's what heals the sick. And my father in the booklet talks about this referring primarily to spiritual healing. I mean, there's people of God who are in danger of losing their eternal lives. And James here is talking about saving lives and how that God heals. He always heals. If we just have the effectual, fervent prayers needed to break through to God, like that end time Elijah. He was a man just like you and me, as verse 17 says. But he prayed earnestly that it wouldn't rain for 3.5 years. And then he prayed for it to rain again. And that's what happened. My father in the booklet, he talks about how that, 19 years of age and not even baptized yet. When I first read Malachi's message on July 16th, 1989, and he has a great section in the James booklet about how this is a challenge, this history. It should challenge our young people. We've got two Philadelphia youth camps going on, or one at least in Edmond, and another one to start a little over a week from now here at Edstone. And as my father says in the James booklet, I mean, look at what God will do for and through young people if they'll develop the kind of prayer life that's spoken of here at the last part of James 5. If they'll commit their lives to God. We have, as my father says in the James booklet, I still feel young. I'm not so young anymore, but we have such a strong connection to Malachi's message, to the beginning of the Philadelphia Church of God. That's our history. And look at, even before he died, look at how involved Mr. Armstrong was in youth programs and how many that he started for the sake of the youth. God needs our young people to really get grounded in Malachi's message and all the other latter rain that he just keeps pouring down. Never mind if there's no physical rain, whether in Edmond or here. We could use some. It would be nice. But as for spiritual rain, I mean, it has been an absolute torrential downfall since July 16th, 1989. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to send us an email, don't forget to do that, and give us your feedback. Give us your PYC experiences. We'd love to hear that at this time of year as well. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you next time.